Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it all comes down to, will the public option make it into the Senate's version of health care reform? There are a lot of pots boiling in Washington today, but let's start with the Senate Finance Committee vote on a government-run plan to compete with private insurance. Two polls out this week paint two different pictures. Rasmussen, which polls likely voters, puts support for a public option at just 35%. A broader CBS poll says it's more like 65%. Mark Halperin is Time Magazine's senior political analyst and editor-at-large. And Mark, there are two main proposals from the Senate committee for a public option. These are from Senate Democrats. Why don't you start by just telling about both of them?
Well, a public option would be more like what a lot of liberals want and what exists in a lot of other industrialized democracies, a so-called single-payer system. It wouldn't go to single-payer, wouldn't mean we'd all be in a government-run health care plan, but one proposal that the Democrats and Republicans will consider today is from Senator Rockefeller of West Virginia. He'd like a plan that would be very much like Medicare, a government plan that would set fees with doctors and hospitals and other medical providers that anyone could join. You'd buy in. If you were poor, you'd become a member automatically, like with Medicaid, and that plan would have economies of scale, would be a big insurer in the country. And the hope is, for people like Senator Rockefeller, is that would do things like get us closer to universal coverage and offset the power of the insurance companies, that a private plan, a public plan rather, would offset what he considers to be one of the main problems, if not the main problem, which is the power and profits of the insurance companies.
Right. He says it will force private insurers to lower their prices and also be an avenue for people who aren't poor enough for Medicaid.
Exactly.
Right now. Yep.
So bring in more people to the system, create that economy of scale and a public plan that has the government behind it, and again, compete with the insurance companies in a way that he thinks would break their monopoly and break their profits. Senator Schumer of New York has a plan that's also a public option of sorts, but it would operate more like a private company, a private insurer. It would not set rates. The government wouldn't set the rates, but it would negotiate like a private insurance company does with medical providers, again, doctors and hospitals and others. Both these plans are short of what a lot of people in the labor movement would like, what a lot of liberals would like. They're short, frankly, of what President Obama would like, but they do have the same broad goal, which is to try to, as we've said, offset the power of the insurance companies. And it's up in the air now whether either of these plans will gain support. Unlikely they'll pass, but a lot of the talk today is talk to make a point as we go forward in the process.
Right, and opponents, of course, have been saying that a public option will force private insurance out of business and allow employers to choose to pay a penalty rather than pay insurance for their workers because they'll just slide their workers over to a public option. But Republicans haven't had to say much. In watching the hearings today, the tensions seem to be between the Democrats, Jay Rockefeller and Max Baucus of Montana. Now, Baucus has come under fire from progressive groups. He heads this committee. And the Progressive Change Campaign Committee and Democracy for America have a commercial out. It airs in Montana and D.C. And in this commercial, a 26-year-old father is talking about his struggles to pay $100,000 in hospital bills that he got after a congenital heart defect and he couldn't get insurance. Here's a clip.
Senator Baucus, when you take millions of dollars from health and insurance interests that oppose reform and oppose giving families like mine the choice of a public option, I have to ask, whose side are you on?
Mark Halperin, how damaging is this for Democrats?
Well, it is a family feud now. As you suggest, the real debate now is within the Democratic Party. Ever since it became clear, and we can talk about whose fault this is, but ever since it became clear that Republicans, for the most part, were not going to be part of this discussion, that there was no compromise to be had with them, this has become a debate within the Democratic Party. And some, like Senator Rockefeller in particular, say, look, we're doing this with Democratic votes only. Let's not trim our sails. Let's not compromise with ourselves. Let's go for what we want, which is more something closer to universal coverage, something closer to a single-payer system. Senator Baucus is the chair of the Finance Committee, which is the last major committee to be considering what kind of plan they're going to put forward, is more of a moderate. He's looking for something that he can not only pass with Democratic votes, but something that he thinks the country would accept. And I think Senator Baucus's view is that the kind of plan that Senator Rockefeller or Senator Schumer would like through these amendments would be too big, too bureaucratic, and too expensive to win the kind of broad-based backing, not just in the public, but again amongst more moderate Democrats like Baucus in the Senate and even in the House, where obviously they're going to eventually have to be a compromise as well if there's to be a law.
Well, we should say the public option is in the House bills that have yet to be shaped, and the two houses are going to meet to put together one bill. So is your sense that in just the few seconds we have, it can be revived then?
it might be revived then, but I find it difficult. The vote count would still be the same in the Senate. I think they're going to have some sort of compromise. The one Republican still in play in the Senate, Olympia Snowe of Maine, has a public option with a trigger, which is to say it would kick in if the insurance company's strength continues. And I think that's probably right now the most likely compromise we'll see in the end.
Which some would say that's kicking it down the road, but that may be the answer. Mark Halperin, Time Magazine senior political analyst, who also writes the page for Time.com. Mark, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, also today, 24-year-old Najibullah Zazi pled not guilty to charges of conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction. Those bombs, investigators say, the Afghan immigrant tried to make in a Denver hotel room. In a Brooklyn courthouse today, Zazi's attorney said there's been a rush to judgment. And responding to claims that law enforcement officials know the identities of at least three other people who worked with Zazi, his lawyer said he didn't know any of their names. So Zazi had a day in court. But how did he get there? How did investigators even know to track him? And how many of the tools of the Patriot Act did they use to gather their information? How much will all of this impact the current debate over renewing aspects of the Patriot Act, which are set to expire this December? We want to follow the trail from wiretaps to police towing Zazi's car once he drove to New York from Denver right before September 11th. We want to do that with Evan Perez, who covers the Justice Department for the Wall Street Journal. So, Evan, start us off with, what was the red flag that even started the interest in Zazi?
Well, according to law enforcement officials that I've talked to, there is something that there is some kind of trigger that occurred that caused them to want to look at him. They've done briefings with members of Congress in which they discussed, for example, that he came into contact with somebody that they knew was an al-Qaeda figure or somebody related to al-Qaeda, and that prompted them to look more closely. Perhaps it was an intelligence intercept. Officials haven't explained fully what it was, but it's clear that once they found a reason to be interested in him, they went back and started looking at his travel records. And that's quite surprising, actually. A lot of us who were reading the files assumed that if you take a flight from New York to Peshawar in Pakistan, where there's a lot of activity with al-Qaeda, that would throw up a flag. But actually, authorities that we talked to and the officials, the investigators that we've talked to, tell us that, frankly, the population of people who are traveling back and forth with Pakistan, it's just a large number that it would lead them to be looking at way too many people. So it had to be something else.
Well, a couple questions. So the chronology, you're saying that there was some sort of intercept that piqued their curiosity initially. What do you think that might have been? I mean, an email or something?
It may have been email, may have been a simple thing, like, for example, if they find that a person that they've been watching for some time communicated with Zazi.
And how would they get that? Would that be from ongoing data mining, let's say?
That would probably be from data mining. It would probably be from perhaps surveillance of another suspect who we don't know here. The officials haven't identified him.
Well, so a red flag rises, and they start on-the-ground surveillance. What does that mean?
Well, they assigned FBI agents, become simple shoe leather investigative work, and they start keeping an eye on him. They also are wiretapping him. It's clear from the documents. They hear him talking on multiple occasions with people about the ingredients for explosives.
We understand some of this wiretapping is around September 6th and 7th of this year. And is this where they hear him call associates, as they're listed, to ask feverishly, how you mix ingredients to make a bomb?
That's right. He starts making these requests like more urgently, saying he wants to get the mixture correctly and so on. And that prompts them to start, again, looking to see where possibly he might be trying to do this. It's not clear exactly when they decide, but they go back and look at hotel rooms in the Colorado area where he apparently rented a room and found a vent above a stove, signs of some of the ingredients that might be used for explosives.
So now, by the time, a couple days later, when he rents a car to go to New York, they've got to be nervous.
They're nervous. They're very nervous. September 11th is coming up, and he is on his way into New York, where he's stopped on the George Washington Bridge by Port Authority police. And they stop him under the guise of that it's a random drug search. He is suspicious about it, but apparently doesn't do anything. And the officers search the car. They don't find anything suspicious, anything to worry about. So they let him go. And he continues on and goes to Flushing, where he has friends that he's staying with.
Well, and at what point do they discover the scanned notes of how to make a bomb on his laptop?
Well, that occurs after he's parked the car in New York, and the authorities have it towed, ostensibly for some kind of parking violation. And Zazi, again, is a little bit more suspicious, but he doesn't know that the officers are looking at this. And this became the treasure trove. This is what tells them everything about what Zazi was doing, even as far back as when he went to Pakistan, what email address he was using to send documents to himself.
So he sent himself this scanned, several-page handwritten note about how to put together a bomb. But he also did all these Internet searches.
Right. He's clearly looking for ingredients, according to the authorities. And also he's looking for ingredients that are apparently safer to handle, because obviously he later tells the authorities that he's received training in this, he's looking for something that's lower in fumes and safer to handle for him to be able to figure this out.
This is all allegedly. Well, so we've got authorities looking at his computer, wiretapping him, going back over his travel records, and also, as you said, still, you know, doing the old-fashioned gumshoe work of just following him. Did they have him in their sights at all times?
They are following him, and it does appear that they lose him a couple of times, because at some point in the time that he's up in New York, NYPD officers approach some associates of Zazi and are looking to see if they could find him, including this imam, Ahmad Afzali. And they show a picture of Zazi asking, have you seen him? Do you know where he is? And it's clear then at that point they don't quite know where he is.
This is when the investigation starts to unravel, because, as we know, the imam goes to Zazi and allegedly tips him off that the authorities are on his tail.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. It's clear that once he's been warned by Afzali, according to the authorities, by the way, they pick this up on a wiretap as well. Mm-hmm. They get this phone call, and Zazi explains that he's suspicious about why his car was towed, and Afzali asks him, is there any evidence in the car? And Zazi says no. After that conversation, Zazi decides that he has to fly back to Denver immediately, goes and buys a ticket and flies back September 12th. The authorities are still watching him, and that's when they come in and ask for search warrants. They get permission from a judge to go in and do some searches. They discover that his laptop no longer has the hard drive that they already knew existed, because they had already searched it, obviously.
That's Evan Perez, Justice Department correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, a lot of people are wondering how much of the evidence against Nasibullah Zazi was collected because of expanded surveillance powers granted to investigators under the Patriot, which is partly up for renewal. We'll ask Evan about that. And later turn to Afghanistan as the debate continues today over how to move forward. What exactly is the strategy now? Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation today about the investigation of terrorism suspect Nasibullah Zazi. We're speaking with Evan Perez, Justice Department correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. And Evan, you've laid out for us how investigators used good old-fashioned police work, such as tracking down leads or using on-the-ground surveillance, but also with the FBI used digital fingerprints, Internet searches, notes on laptops. Now, the Patriot Act, which was passed after 9/11, gave law enforcement greater access to court-approved roving wiretaps of cell phones and emails in case, you know, people change their cell phone numbers, also library and business records. So the question many are asking, is there anything in the Zazi investigation that would only have been made possible because of the Patriot Act?
That's a very difficult question. The authorities won't say whether they used Patriot Act authorities to do any of their sleuthing here. They have said, for example, however, that they are going to use data and information that was gained through what is known as a FISA warrant, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and they will introduce some of that evidence into court. Now, the Patriot Act did tweak a lot of different authorities that the government has to do surveillance. So it's very likely that it's almost certain that they used some of the authority that they have under the Patriot Act to do some of the police work and some of the analysis here. What is not clear is whether, if the Patriot Act wasn't there, would they have been able to do the same thing? I don't know that we can answer that because the authorities, again, are not saying exactly what it is they did.
Well, we know that they, for instance, read his emails, but he gave them consent for that. They got something called a consent search towards the end of the investigation. And so that's outside the Patriot Act, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yep. They went through his laptop and saw all his Internet searches. Now, is that something you could do outside of the Patriot Act?
Well, you know, people who are critical of the Patriot Act and its broadness would argue that, for example, a lot of the police work that you do in cases like this can be done using regular authorities that you have on the criminal laws. What the government likes about the Patriot Act in particular is that in terrorism investigations, they want to be able to protect some of their methods, some of the intelligence sources perhaps. A lot of people have a problem with that because it's very hard to verify and to check what the government is up to. There's a lot we don't know, and you know, there's a tradition in this country of trust but verify, and the verification part of this is what is difficult here.
So we don't know what some of the techniques were that were used, but still, this terrorism case is being used in Washington to serve different purposes. How is it being used politically?
Well, there are many people in Congress who view the Zazi case, for example, and some of the other more recent cases as reason to renew the authorities of the Patriot Act, which are coming up to expire at the end of December. Now, on the other side, there are a lot of folks who've been waiting years since 9/11 for a chance to revisit some of these things. We know that there have been some abuses in the use of things, some of these powers, and they view it as a chance, for example, to revisit, for example, the National Security Letters Law, which allows the FBI to issue essentially administrative subpoenas without any kind of judicial oversight.
So you can get transaction records, for instance, how many times someone called Peshawar, but you still, if you want to get content of that phone call, you have to get a wiretap.
Right, and there are some additional safeguards that have been put into place because there's a lot of concern about this. So a lot of folks on Capitol Hill, some Democrats, are looking for a chance to be able to revisit some of these laws. And, of course, you know, this case coming down the pike just as they start reopening this debate has sort of thrown everybody for a loop because I think they know that, you know, once you have fearful members of Congress, it's very hard for members of Congress to essentially say that they want to add additional safeguards or additional privacy measures when you have a big terrorism case unfolding.
Well, Senator Patrick Leahy, a Democrat of Vermont and the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, is one who wants to toughen standards for national security letters. He wants them to have expiration dates. But he also wants to continue the Patriot Act with maybe some revisions for 4 years. And Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, also a Democrat, is asking, you know, is there anything in doing that that will impede the ongoing investigations, not just in Colorado and New York, but others? So it's not just Republicans who are saying, hey, you know, now may not be the time to do anything to revise the Patriot Act.
Right. And then the Obama administration, had spent several months without saying how they felt about the reauthorization of these authorities. It wasn't until 2 weeks ago that they sent a letter to Capitol Hill in which they finally endorsed the idea that the Patriot Act sections, these three provisions, that they be reauthorized. And so now you have the administration saying, we want the Patriot Act provisions reauthorized. We're open to talking about some fixes if you want to add some privacy safeguards, but we want it reauthorized.
Evan, one last question. When we talked to you last week when this story was breaking, one question that jumped out is, where are the other people that might be involved in this? The court documents talk about Zazi calling associates to ask them frantically about mixing ingredients. And also, there's the footage of him going through the aisles of a beauty supply store buying these ingredients. Where are the ingredients and who are the associates?
There's a lot of information that they haven't announced, and they are aware of these other associates. They just haven't told us who they are. It's possible that they're still working on some of them. They might even still be interviewing some of them. Some of them might be cooperating. And that those are all reasons why you wouldn't name those people. There is no indication that they're hunting for people that they don't know where they are. The posture that, that law enforcement has taken on this case is that there's no imminent threat. So there's nothing that they're worried about necessarily going off anytime soon. But they are watching a bunch of people, and that and they're talking to a whole host of folks.
Okay. Evan Perez, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Evan Perez, Justice Department correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Well, this quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to hear questions facing the Supreme Court this new term, like, is it a crime to sell videos of dogfighting if you haven't made them? And can the government erect a cross in a national forest? That's tomorrow. And before we go today, it's sort of a fiddler's orchestra. They're called Child's Play. But the latest news is next, Here and Now. To Chicago now, where four teenagers have been charged in the beating death of 16-year-old Darion Albert, an honor student caught in a huge and violent melee on his walk home from school. The beating was captured on a video camera by another student. A warning, even the sound is brutal, and the pictures show Darion being beaten with lumber, then stomped on before friends drag him away. As horrific as the attack is, it's the third outside a Chicago school in just the 3 weeks since the new year started, and it's part of a three-year escalation of violence on or near Chicago school property. The AP reports that before 2006, an average of 10 to 15 students were fatally shot every year. That's bad enough, but last year, the number rose to 34 deaths and 290 shootings. Chicago Tribune reporter Kristen Mack joins us. She's on assignment on the streets in Chicago. And Kristen, we understand police are looking for more suspects in Darion Albert's death?
Yes, they are. And the videotape that the student shot has really been instrumental in helping police. It happened next door to a community center that had surveillance tape, and so they were able to capture it on video. But when the student, a few days later, handed over this handheld camcorder footage to police, it really made a difference.
Well, it also brings home the violence that apparently, and according to what we're reading, Chicago students live with on almost a daily basis as they try to get to and from school. Or as your fellow Chicago reporter Mark Brown writes in the Sun-Times, it's not school that's the problem, it's getting in and out of it. What are people there in Chicago saying about that?
It was interesting yesterday to see these kids coming to school because many of them live in the neighborhood. They walk to school. These aren't kids who have parents dropping them off and picking them up after school. And just the walk to and from the bus stop or the walk to and from their homes, sometimes they're walking through, you know, different neighborhoods that have long-going rivalries against each other. But I will say that the problem does follow them inside. It's the breeding ground for a lot of the contempt that happens once they leave school property.
Well, we understand on that day, Thursday, where this melee broke out, there had been a shooting earlier that day and tensions between two neighborhood groups, groups which we understand regularly converge outside schools to wait for their friends to come out. Shouldn't that have been a red flag to the school that there might be trouble later that day if there was a shooting in the morning?
Yeah, and what's interesting is that cops acknowledged yesterday they really need to share information more readily because if something happens on the streets, it may have started in the school.
And we understand that action was taken immediately to get more kids on board buses?
Right. If you have kids who have a 10-block walk to the bus stop, there's a whole lot that can happen. Sometimes people waiting at those bus stops to harass these kids once they get there.
And we understand there's another initiative underway to prevent violence among the Chicago high school students. The school chief there creating a list of 200 students most likely to get shot. And what's he going to do with those kids?
What he wants to do is to set those kids up with mentors so that they have an adult outside of their home that they can have a relationship with, and then also help get them jobs so that they have something constructive to do outside of school hours. What some of the people in the neighborhood are saying is, okay, you have a list of kids who are most likely to get shot. But as we see with the deaths of the three students since the school year started, none of them were on that list.
Well, Kristen, one last question. But by far, this is not the most important one. We're thinking today the most important thing are these kids and the kids who were traumatized by being in the middle of that melee. And this is also an image that's now going around the world. And it's probably not the image Chicago wants ricocheting around the world as it makes its bid for the Olympics.
In some ways, people who live in Chicago, in some ways we sort of take it as a commonplace event. But to have it captured on video, it really is, you know, this is the way a lot of people live in Chicago. And, you know, I don't know that it will affect the bid. I don't know. But this is the reality for a lot of the children who live in this city.
Kristen Mack of the Chicago Tribune. Kristen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
Okay, we'll be back after a 30-second break, here and now. President Obama is holding a series of meetings today on the war in Afghanistan, and it's at a familiar point in the debate. U.S. commanders are calling for thousands of additional troops, but Vice President Joe Biden and others calling for a reduction and more concentrated counterterrorism campaign. Well, while leaders meet to talk about the future today, we want to focus on what the U.S. military strategy in Afghanistan is right now. And we'll do that with Rajiv Chandrasekaran, associate editor at The Washington Post. He was in Afghanistan recently and joins us with what he saw there. Rajiv, welcome as always.
Hey, good day, Robin.
And help us understand, what are American and NATO forces doing in Afghanistan right now? We know about 68,000 Americans there. What are they doing?
That's a very good question. They're doing a lot of different things. General Stanley McChrystal, the overall commander of U.S. and NATO forces there, wants most of them, in fact, all of them, to be focused on counterinsurgency operations, which involves less raids on Taliban strongholds, more efforts at protecting Afghan civilians in cities and towns, trying to restore basic order so people can go about their daily lives, reasoning that if you can restore a degree of normalcy, if you can reduce Taliban intimidation and attacks against the civilian population, you can build sort of pockets of stability that he hopes will sort of expand outward and eventually cover the map of the country. Well, the part of the problem is that there are specific units that are doing more counterinsurgency than others, but we still have a lot of troops that are doing more conventional type operations, hunting insurgents up in remote mountain valleys where there are really not that many people. And a number of our NATO partners, particularly in the northern and western parts of the country, are doing more sort of traditional sort of security patrolling type operations and less counterinsurgency. And that's really something that General McChrystal wants to change, regardless of whether he gets more troops in there or not.
Well, when you say counterinsurgency, it's a little confusing, only in that, you know, some people might be thinking of counterinsurgency, that means you go kill Taliban members. But that's not what's meant by that. It's meant to actually work with Afghans so that they feel more comfortable with American troops and might they themselves take on the Taliban?
Indeed. I mean, think of it this way. It's a bit like community policing. Instead of perhaps sitting in the station and then going out to respond to reports that somebody has robbed a house or assaulted somebody and chasing them down, it involves just maintaining a presence in the community, making people feel secure so that people feel like they can go and walk the streets and be out after dark. It's much the same way in Afghanistan.
Well, and we know that American deaths more than doubled from the same period last year. Is it because there are more troops, or is it because they're out, you know, in the villages trying to win hearts and minds?
Well, it's both of those things, and it's also the Taliban has become increasingly potent. Their size has grown. Their sophistication has increased. They are laying larger roadside bombs, conducting more sophisticated ambushes. But yes, with additional troops having flowed into the country over the past several months, you'll recall that President Obama authorized back in February the deployment of 21,000 additional U.S. forces. That means there are more military personnel out on patrols, and that means there are more targets out there for the enemy. So that's why we've seen a spike in casualties. But what military officials say is that, look, you need need to be getting out there and patrolling, even at some human cost, if you really want to change this, the dynamics there. If you just stay in your bases, if you stay in big armored vehicles, you'll never engage with the population, and you'll never eventually convince them to stop laying these bombs.
Well, this is the same thinking that General Petraeus unwrapped in Iraq, the thinking of going to work with Iraqis to win them over and convince them that they should turn around and fight, in that case, Al-Qaeda fighters in Iraq. The difference is that these Taliban in Afghanistan are Afghans in large part, and we understand from your reading of intelligence reports, you're saying that they are not as happy about Al-Qaeda, that they are not extending a welcome mat to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
That's true. The insurgency is very much a localized indigenous movement in Afghanistan, driven largely by local grievances. In fact, you know, our popular conception of the Taliban back here in the United States is of a bunch of religious extremists, the sorts of guys wearing their black turbans who ruled the country back in the late 90s until shortly after the September 11th attacks. Yes, there is an element of religious extremism to the regrouping Taliban, but in many cases, Afghans are joining them because they are upset at the corruption of their own government, of the insecurity there, and the Taliban provides them something of an alternative. The instructive comparison with Iraq, though, was that the United States eventually was able to reach out to one group of the insurgency in Iraq, the Sunni fighters, and get them essentially to switch sides, to turn against Al-Qaeda, to sort of take up arms in support of the government through the Sons of Iraq program. It's going to be much more complicated to do that in Afghanistan. American commanders, American diplomats would love to see similar type programs in Afghanistan, but in Afghanistan, you have so many tribal differences, so many regional differences and rivalries that it would be impossible to do such a large-scale program like you did in Iraq, and you'd have to do narrower, more focused things in Afghanistan, which will be much more difficult to bring about.
Well, so here we are at the same debate. General McChrystal not saying it, but others saying what he's calling for is nation-building, more troops, really a full onslaught. Vice President Biden and others saying Afghanistan is too complicated, we've got to draw it down, and concerns that President Obama might go up the middle. Just in the minute or so we have, a sense of where this might go, Rajiv?
Well, I think everything's on the table right now. Those who believe that we should narrow the mission very significantly and just go on targeted counterterrorism missions, that camp, I think, has expanded from just Vice President Biden to include other players in the national
sure.
security arena. Obviously, General McChrystal has a very strong argument for a more fully resourced counterterrorism insurgency mission. There may be a tendency to try to split the difference here, but a number of folks I talk to warn that trying to do the middle ground may be the most dangerous thing here, and what President Obama really needs to do is to pick one and then pursue it with vigor.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran of The Washington Post, who was in Afghanistan recently, giving us his point of view. Rajiv, thanks as always.
A pleasure to talk to you.
And we'll, of course, keep watching that story to see how that plays out. But in a minute, we're going to take a break from all the news and hear the glorious music of Child's Play, 14 Fiddlers, playing instruments built by just one man. And you'll hear that in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. The Sound of Child's Play, a collective of musicians who, since 1986, have gotten together from time to time to record and tour their repertoire of ballads, reels, and jigs, built largely around a single instrument, the violin. There are 14 fiddlers in Child's Play, and from Scottish champions to members of the Boston Symphony Orchestra, they're a diverse group, but they have one thing in common. Their instruments were all made by the same man.
What you want to hear is like a bell-like sound. they're a beautiful sustain that kind of lingers and decays gradually.
That's Bob Childs. He's been building violins for 35 years. So far, he's made about 150 instruments. It takes him about 200 hours to craft just one. They go for $16,000 apiece. And his clients include some of the most accomplished string players in the world. But just making instruments wasn't enough for Bob Childs. That's the reason Childs Play exists. Bob Childs is taking a break from his violin making to visit us in our studios to talk about his group and their fifth recording, Waiting for the Dawn, which, Bob, is the first to mesh voice and violin, isn't it?
Yes, this is a chance for us to really display the relationship between the voice and the violin.
In the trees I sensed it. Through the walls the debtors cry, see their tears in the river.
And one of the voices, and the violin playing as well, belongs to Hanneke Castle, as she's one of Child's Play's fiddlers. Hanneke, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Bob, just how did Child's Play come about?
It's actually funny how it started because I got a phone call one day inviting me down to Washington, D.C. to play in a concert. And at the end of the conversation, the person said, oh, by the way, the name of the band is Child's Play because everyone in the group is going to be playing your instruments.
So they told you.
They invited me to be in the band.
In your band.
Yes.
Named after you. Well, and by the way, how does that feel? You send the instruments out. I suppose it's like children at some point.
Oh, it's absolutely like children. Yeah, because you're very connected to them. You put your heart and soul into it. And then you have to let go and trust in the hands of great artists that they can really sing.
Well, you gestured towards Hanneke there, so let's bring Hanneke in. You've been a U.S. National Scottish Fiddle Champ?
Yep.
And what makes it Scottish fiddling?
There's different kinds of Scottish fiddling. Some of the music is from the Highlands and imitates the bagpipes. It's related to the singing tradition. So there's different kinds of grace notes and ornaments.
Well, we're dying to hear some. So let's do that. Your violin is right in front of you. Let's hear a little of the title track, Waiting for the Dawn, which we understand you wrote. Let's hear a little.
Okay.
Hanneke Castle playing Waiting for the Dawn from the new Child's Play CD of the same name. So what's it like to play in Child's Play, again, with the violin made by Bob Childs, with others playing Child's violins? How does it feel different from other groups you might play with?
There is a voice. It's like they're related. It's like they're sisters and brothers. So each sister and brother would have completely different personality and might even look way different, but there's going to be certain
something.
We're like a fiddle choir in some way.
You're the Osmonds of fiddles.
Yeah, that's it. Perfect.
Bob Childs, we understand that this new CD and its blending of voice and violin dovetails with your own personal story, a dream you write about on the liner notes. I'll just synopsize. You're trying to get into a country, the border guards there stop you, you're led through a series of rooms and the guards point to a violin, and when you turn the violin over, you see an image of a small boy crying. What does that dream mean?
This dream was like a pivotal moment in my life, actually, because it helped me really understand why I made violins. You know, in the first 3 years of my life, I was in five different foster homes, and to really kind of sit with the profound disorientation that I didn't really have a way of explaining or understanding. It only took a lot of time and experience of trying to reflection on myself and my own experience that I came to realize that the violin was actually giving me a voice of, you know, obviously painful experiences that somehow needed to be expressed, and perhaps the genesis of a lot of great art.
Let's listen to a little more of it. This is I Am a Youth, That's a traditional Irish ballad. Aoife O'Donovan is singing on this. Let's listen.
And to conclude and to end these verses, may God protect this young female fair and keep her from every wild embarrassment. And of my darling, take the greatest care, for she's sold to anger and a kind disposition. And it shakes like roses in June deep blood. And my madness slumbers whenever I think of her. I can code her vision in America.
Aoife O'Donovan on Child's Play's new CD, giving, as Bob Child said, voice to the story of youth. And now, Bob Child, you're doing arrangements of Steve Earle, Elvis Presley, U2, Mothers of the Disappeared. That's on this CD as well. Where do you see it going from here?
There's two different ways I'd like to see this grow. I mean, one of them is that our website is really getting much more community-focused. We're asking different people in the group to come in and give like a 10-minute violin lesson about their fiddling, sort of the moment when they went from a really good player to a great player, an inspirational moment. And so one of the things we'd like to do is have these free downloadable videos on our website and try to inspire a next generation of musicians.
Well, and Hanukkah, as you're a part of that, are there a lot of young people picking up the fiddle now? I mean, to be part of this merging of traditional and modern.
There are just so many teenagers out there that are interested in fiddle. And also, it's that time in your life when it's hard to find places to fit in. And I actually just came from a fiddle camp that I started going to when I was 16. And for me, it was always this little haven away from high school to have community with these other people who also like to play the fiddle, which is something that happens in Child's Play, too. It's not just about getting up there and playing the music, but, you know, partying together and laughing and stuff.
Traveling in the bus.
Yeah, exactly.
And having whatever comes of that. That's Hanukkah Castle, one of Child's Play's 14 fiddlers. Bob Child is a violin maker in Cambridge, Massachusetts. The group named after him because they all play his fiddles. Their latest CD is Waiting for the Dawn. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Bob and Hanukkah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.